This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
Taking matters into our own hands. This seems like a perfectly rational and splendid idea. I read online how, in light of recent data breaches with large companies, the encouragement was that I should take matters into my own hands when it comes to handling cybersecurity. Things like having an updated and secure password, or keeping software updated, or how I could ensure my own safety when it comes to these breaches with large companies. Sounds good, right? I mean, there's makes common sense, right? That I do have a responsibility and I need to take matters into my own hands. Like if my password's 1234, I might get hacked. Okay, so makes sense. But when it comes to God, taking matters into our own hands often backfires. I mean, think about Adam and Eve in the garden, right? Satan even comes and says, look at this. God doesn't know what he's talking about. Look at how beautiful this is. Did he really say? And so they took matters into their own hands and we all fell. Or Abraham, God's made promise to him, you know, like your descendants are going to number like the stars in the seashore, or stars in the sky, sand on the seashore. And, you know, they're advancing in age, and so Abraham thinks, like, I need to take matters into my own hands. And so Sarah's even game, you know, like, hey, here's my servant. Have a child with her. Maybe this is God's plan. And just gets hairy and weird. Joseph's brothers, you know, this is just a mama's boy. I mean, this is dad's favorite. We're never going to get anything as long as he's around. So let's just get rid of him. Let's take matters into our own hands. So God can sometimes and often does work in each of these stories in redemptive ways, right? So he's redeemed us from the curse of Adam. He overcame the taking matters into his own hands with Abraham and certainly overcame that. It was all, you know, with Joseph, we all get the backstory in Genesis 50. This was all part of his plan in the first place. And we're just scratching our heads going, whoa, God, you're big. but his plan or his way is not when we take matters into our own hands. His way is that we trust him. And those are the options, by the way. We either trust him or we take matters into our own hands. We try to fix things ourselves. We either walk in his way or we go our own way. Now, you might remember in 1 Samuel, we're watching the rise of David, as in King David. Ever since his anointing in 1 Samuel 16, or dealing with Goliath in chapter 17, or serving in Saul's court, to being on the run from Saul, it seemed that David's stock is rising. After all, we know the secret to his success. God is with him. That makes a big difference. God is not with Saul. God's spirit has departed from Saul, and so Saul is spiraling downward. And so we're in a chapter in 1 Samuel 25 where, you might remember where this ended last time, that David had spared Saul's life. He had cut off a corner of his robe while he was using the bathroom in the cave. And there were all kinds of, there was a back and forth. David said something, Saul said something, and it looked like everything was all rosy and happy, but Saul went his way, David went his way. And so we pick up today in 1 Samuel 25, and we have a chapter where Saul is mostly absent from the action. Like I mentioned, this is the second of three chapters that take place when David is tempted in the wilderness. So chapter 24 began within the wilderness. Our passage today is going to begin with in the wilderness. Chapter 26 is going to happen in the wilderness. And there's a temptation, and it's the same temptation that Jesus faced. Is he going to trust his father and do things his father's way, or is he going to take matters into his own hands? That's the temptation. And today, he'll need someone to intervene, David will. He'll need someone to intervene in his life to keep him from going down the path of the fool. David could turn into Saul really quickly. So let's see how God intervenes to restrain him. We're going to see this over and over again. That's going to be a refrain in this chapter. You could even look for that as we're reading. Just mark this, where God restrained him. God restrained him. God restrained him. I mean, it just comes up over and over again. So, as it relates to us, I wonder if you trust yourself to fix things or if you're trusting God. Another way to word this would be, do you tend to be repentant or unrepentant? When was the last time you were shown something and really changed your way? How teachable are you really? Or have you slowly drifted into thinking that you don't need the insights of others, they'll just make life difficult? Maybe you've slowly began to pride yourself on what you know, how you see an issue, and what it looks like lived out. But do you suspect yourself? Do you suspect your tendency to go your own way? Maybe you're rushing into a kind of action and God's trying to get your attention. He's trying to wake you up and say, hey, hold on here. How are you responding to him and to his helpers? These are all the questions that get at the nature of our hearts. Are we self-sufficient, taking matters into our own hands and relying on our own strength? Or are we trusting in God? Are we very God-dependent, recognizing that apart from him, we'll fail, drift, or even step outside of pursuing his plans and his way? This is all the kind of stuff that comes to focus in our passage today. And just watch. Just watch it play out. Do you tend to be like David? Do you tend to be like Nabal? This is what's going to be seen in our passage today. The responses of these two guys today both show how people respond to the message of salvation in our world. Some people respond by digging in their heels, being unrepentant. They're not going to budge. And others respond just by saying, I need help. Yeah, this is a mess. I need help. And so today, do you tend to be more like Nabal? Like you're not going to budge. You have all the answers. You don't need any help. Or do you tend to be like David, who needs help? God sends it, and David responds. So stay curious about this. And as it relates to your Christian walk, too. Some of you can remember just glory days back in your past when you were really close to God and you were learning from him and your life was changing, you were growing. And some of you haven't changed in years. And you're going through life acting like outside things are the problem. And you're just missing it. It's your heart. Are you active in repenting? Is your heart characterized by tenderness and love? As God sends helpers your way, do you respond with humility? Or do you argue for the high ground? The high ground. I mean, isn't it curious that we put it that way? Like, I have the high ground on this issue. What if God's calling you to the lowlands so that you can get dirty with some sinners? So this is the kind of stuff that we need to think about. We need to be careful. God can have the final say. So this passage warns us to avoid doing things on our way and to trust God. So today, I invite you to join me as we see three ways that we can avoid doing things on our own terms when it comes to God's plan. That's our outline. Three ways that we can avoid doing things on our own terms when it comes to God's plan. So let's get into the story. 1 Samuel 25, and we'll begin by reading verses 1 through 13. Here's what we read there. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran, and there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife was Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name, and thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shears. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm. And they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who's David? Who's the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their master. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?" So David's young man turned away and came back and told him all this. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on your sword." And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So, three ways that we can avoid doing things on our own terms when it comes to God's plan. And first of all, we can avoid doing things on our own terms when it comes to God's plan by reminding ourselves that opportunity does not equal mandate. There it is again. Opportunity does not equal mandate. That was our point last week. David had an opportunity last week to kill Saul in the cave, but opportunity does not equal mandate. And our passage really begins, if we begin back in verse 1, our passage begins in an unexpected way. Samuel, who had loomed so large in this book, especially in the opening chapters of the book, remember there was no vision from God in those days, and then all of a sudden Samuel bursts on the scene and the Lord appears by the word of the Lord at Shiloh. After all, the book's even named is after him. The book of Samuel's named after him, so this seems like a kind of a letdown. I mean, couldn't we have a state funeral for this guy and take up 2 or 3 days on the network to film all that, you know, he had done for the nation? But no, we just are told in verse 1, Samuel died, all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. That's all we're told. But we have to set up chapter 28, so it just gets weird in 28. And Samuel has to be dead for the weirdness of chapter 28 to happen. So we'll get to that. This had to come. So Samuel dies and is buried. And we're introduced right out of the gate to two new characters. David went down to the wilderness of Paran, and there's a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. Now you might remember, we've seen Carmel before. Remember after Saul's alleged rout of the Amalekites, when God told him to completely wipe everything out, and he kept things to worship with and said, "Oh, I've obeyed the Lord completely." And we're actually told in 1 Samuel 15:12 that he set up a monument for himself in Carmel after that great military victory in perfect obedience to God. So there's a monument in Carmel where this guy's shearing his sheep. And listen to how this man's described. He's rich. He's got lots of sheep and lots of goats. He's shearing them. And his name was Nabal. His wife, her name's Abigail, and she's described as discerning and beautiful, and she's contrasted with a husband who's harsh and badly behaved. We're also told that Nabal was a Calebite, which means that should have set him in the line of faithful, God-fearing men, as in Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who was one of the spies who went into the land and said, "Yeah, God's given us the land, let's go take it." And he was one of them who got to enter the promised land. He was a Calebite. But Nabal had gone another way. So David hears he's shearing sheep, and so David extends an offer of peace. 10 young men are sent, and they greet Nabal. And you heard the instructions in verse 6, and listen to what they are. "Peace be to you, peace to your house. Peace be to all that you have. I hear you're shearing, and when your shepherds are with us, we did them no harm. You missed nothing. This is well known. Even others know this. So we desire your favor. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son, David." How kind. David's taking care of all this guy's assets for free in the wilderness. And he's extending peace, peace, peace. And he's asking for help. David has 600 men plus others in the wilderness. They're just walking around, kind of this vagabond group of without a home. They're trying to survive in the wilderness. But we know there's 600 fighting men, and there's probably women and children there. We know that from later chapters. So you can imagine what a burden that would be to feed this group. And so they just go to somebody they've protected and said, hey, can you help us out here? We need some food. You're feasting. God's blessed you. We were part of that blessing. We didn't allow anyone to conquer you. And so they wait for Nabal's reply, and he responds by saying, who's this David? Who's the son of Jesse? There's a lot of servants breaking away. Maybe you're a vagabond like them, a rebel without a cause, a nobody. Shall I take bread, water, and meat that I've killed from my own and give it to men who come from I don't know where? I mean, did you hear all the self-centeredness in verse 11? All the references to I and my. It almost sounds like, reminds me of like Nebuchadnezzar, remember in Daniel chapter 4? Is this not Babylon the Great that I have made with my own hands? And God quickly is going to teach Nebuchadnezzar a lesson like, actually, I'm the one who put you in power. So why don't you go chew on some grass for a while? This is what we get with when we read Nabal. Is this not? And you know, listen, we don't need to be all judgy towards Nabal because you and I are exactly the same way. Hey, let's get together. Well, I have something going in my time, and I'm not sure that I have time for that. Are we just not being that kind of selfish? Yeah, of course. So we know this. We know what's going on. David's men return. They give him news, and we get a sense of David's estimation of this reply as we see David retaliate with the sword. So the greeting was peace, peace, peace. And now listen in verse 13. David said to his men, every man strap on his sword. And every man strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. So what's the writer wanting us to see? It's not the time for peace anymore. Sword, sword, sword. Or give me S words for 500, Alex. You know, get it. There's a battle coming. David's fighting force of 600 will be broken up between 400 fighting men and 200 staying with all the stuff. So what we should be curious about is, notice how David is reacting much more violently to a smaller offense than the previous chapter. Right? What happened in chapter 24? Saul is seeking his life. Saul's trying to kill him. And what does David do? Well, he snips off a corner of his robe. Hey, Saul, look what I got. And I've dishonored the Lord's anointed. And now here's a man who has simply, David said, hey, would you mind sharing with us? And the man said, no. And so David says, okay, put on your sword. He's an Israelite. I'm going to be king. Let's kill this fool right now. He's ready to bring the thunder. So he needs to remember that opportunity does not equal mandate. It's even what kind of Nabal's saying to him, right? Nabal's saying, yeah, there's an opportunity here. It doesn't mean mandate. It doesn't mean I have to help you. Nabal's being foolish. Even though David's been slighted, is this the right path? Is this what God has told us in his word? That when someone slights us, we go for the kill? Is that what our religion teaches? Is that what the Bible teaches? Like someone slights you, you go for the kill? So you come to them and say, peace, peace, peace. They wrong you. How dare you? I'm bringing the thunder. In fact, strap on your sword. Let's go. So is David showing a heart of trust, or is he taking matters into his own hands? I wonder how you react when you're offended. Do you look like David or Jesus? In Hebrews 12:3, the writer invites us to consider Jesus. And then here's how we're told to consider Jesus. Listen to this, Hebrews 12:3. Consider Jesus, who endured from sinners such hostility against himself. He endured from sinners such hostility against himself so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. So might your weariness or discouragement be more rooted in your lack of trust or lack of looking to Jesus and taking things into your own hands? You and I forget that opportunity does not equal mandate. The world will resist us. Consider Jesus, who endured such hostility against himself from sinners. He endured that. The world's going to be against you. This is not a shocker. But it is our joy to step into mistreatment like our Lord. It's our joy to share in his sufferings, that we may show them where our trust is. And our trust is not in political power. Our trust is not in the high ground. Our trust is not in positions of strength. But our trust is in the security of our Father, his plans, his ways. That's what we lean into. So, the best way, as we begin, we can avoid doing things on our own terms and trusting God's plan by remembering that opportunity does not equal mandate. Reminding ourselves of this. Well, secondly, another way we can avoid doing things on our own terms and trusting God's plan is by embracing the help that God sends our way. Embracing the help that God sends our way. So let's keep reading, beginning in verse 14. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Look, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us. We suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything while they were in our fields, as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both day and night, all the while we were with them, keeping the sheep. Now therefore know this, and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master, and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him." So, verse 14 turns, right? David's on his way to make this injustice right. Remember, sword, sword, sword. And one of Nabal's men comes and tells Abigail, his wife, that he's being harsh and badly behaved again. That's the biblical word. Like, he's a harsh and badly behaved man. That he's up to this again. That David sent messengers. He recounts the story for Abigail. And the backstory comes from the servant here reporting that David and his men were very good to us. We didn't suffer. We didn't lack anything as long as they were with us. They were a wall to us while we were keeping sheep. They were providing security. And this man recognizes that harm is not only coming to Nabal, but harm is coming to the entire house because of him. And Nabal is so thick. I mean, this is so crazy at the end of verse 14. He's so thick that one cannot speak to him. Are you this way? That one cannot speak to you? I mean, I think this is like just a little gold nugget here in the middle of the story. Because I've had interactions with people before and they're just like this, right? No one can speak to them. They're so worthless. No one can speak to them. When others around are trying to tell you anything, it could be said of you that, man, they're so worthless, no one can even reason with them. Does this describe you? Well, Abigail springs into action in both word and deed. We get a sense of how this is translated into wisdom. So let's begin reading in verse 18. And I'm going to read all the way down to verse 31 now. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seahs of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, "Go on before me, behold, I'll come after you." But she did not tell her husband Nabal. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under the cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her and she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned to me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him." So David's hot. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then, let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. And evil shall not be found in you as long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living and the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. So wisdom. She quickly grabs the bread, the wine, the prepared sheep, the grain, the figs, the raisins, and put these on donkeys. She gave the young men instructions to go before her. She would follow. She didn't tell Nabal. Can't tell him anything anyway. She's coming with the donkeys under the cover of the mountain, and David and his men, armed with swords, come down to meet her, and they meet. David was breathing the injustice. This has been a royal waste of time taking care of these guys, so we'll wipe them off the face of the earth, and he'll learn what happens when you treat good with evil. Great attitude, David. He even invokes an oath from God. May God do so to my enemies if anyone is left alive. So he's scary and harsh. There's a screw loose in David's head. So on the one hand, I just want you to see where Abigail is in the middle here. It's not like David's all righteous and, oh, he's so valiant and brave and, oh, he's so dreamy. David's a nut job here. I mean, he's crazy. He's out of his mind. He's so angry he can't even think straight. So on the one hand, Abigail has a boneheaded husband acting the fool. And on the other hand, she's meeting a boneheaded anointed one acting the fool, threatening to wipe out his own people because they wouldn't do him good. And here's Abigail in the middle. David, we know David is walking in the path of a fool because the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Just because you don't share doesn't mean you get to execute. He's not going to be a wise king if he goes through with this. So Abigail sees David and gets down on her face and bows to the ground, falling at his feet and taking all the blame as if she's guilty. She says, On me alone, Lord, be the guilt. Please let me speak and listen to my words. Don't regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. The word Nabal means fool. So this is who he is. He really lives up to his name. That's what she's saying. I didn't see the young men you sent, but as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, now that God has restrained you from evil. So she's saying, what you're about to do is evil. God's using me to restrain you right in this moment. So now that God's doing this, let your enemies be as Nabal. Accept this food for your young men. Forgive the trespass of your servant. And here's why. Because the Lord is going to make you a sure house. You're the man of God's choosing. As long as you live and fight God's battles, evil's restrained. God's got your back too. I mean, if men come after you, God will care for you. And then in verse 29, she reminds David that God is his strength. May God sling your enemies out as from the hollow of a sling. I mean, she can really turn a phrase here, right? She's saying, you know, hey, you know how enemies are killed with a sling? And David's going, well, kinda, yeah. And she's saying, yeah, that's what God's going to do for you. You're the anointed one. Okay? That's what she's saying. And finally, she ends reminding him that one day when he's king, he's not going to want grief, or he's not going to want a struck conscience for shedding blood without cause. She's saying, you don't want this on your record. That some little person that you took care of didn't share their feast with you, and therefore you executed the entire village. You don't want that, right? I thought God was the one you were serving. I thought God was the one was taking care of you. You don't want to be taking matters into your own hands. God's dealt well with you. And so her application is, so deal well with us. Amazing. Here's a woman, a strong woman, managing folly on both sides. And she's stepping in with generosity. She's inviting God into the conversation. She's not saying, I'm the one restraining you. She's saying, God's the one restraining you. And he's using me. You know, she's making the connection. In both word and deed, she's demonstrating wisdom and care for God's chosen. And her message is pretty simple. God's going to make you king, so don't become king with blood on your hands. Don't do this in your own strength. It's the same temptation as Saul, right? Here he is. This is your moment. Strike him down. And David's saying, no, I'm not going to strike the Lord's anointed. In other words, God's going to have to accomplish this. And so in chapter 25, he's ready to execute bloodshed. And Abigail's saying, this isn't what you want. This isn't what needs to happen in this moment. Look at how David responds in verse 32. David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me truly by morning, there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male. And then David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice and have granted your petition. So David just praises God for this gift. He recognizes that God had sent Abigail. She had been an instrument from God to keep David from blood guilt and from taking matters into his own hands, for working his own salvation. God is the one who had restrained him. If she hadn't intervened, there would have not been left to Nabal one male. So David received the gift and offered her peace. Go up in peace to your house. I've obeyed your voice, granted your petition. So I know you feel this, and I know you can see this, but I'm just struck by how Abigail stepped in into the middle here to intercede and to plead God's cause. This was risky to her. So we read these stories and we're like, oh yeah, of course. You know, who isn't going to stop for a beautiful person or something? You know, whatever. Whatever excuses we make. We don't know. But there was a risk here, right? Some commentators wonder if some of the young men in Nabal's house were maybe her children. She was, you know, I know women reach a different level of strength when Mama Bear comes out, right? So you're not going to affect my kids, you know, so maybe that's what's inspiring her boldness. But it's the Lord. God raised her up for the good of David to intercede on the behalf of others. And I think in doing this, Abigail points to Jesus. So a lot of times in the Bible, we talk about how Moses is seen and Jesus is the true and better Moses. Jesus is the true and better David at times. And Jesus is the true and better Abigail. I mean, think about this. He intervenes to intercede and rescue us. He steps in at great cost to himself to absorb our guilt so that we might be free. And he does that so that we might be free from taking salvation into our own hands, right? That's what he does. Jesus steps in and says, Father, let all the guilt be on me. These people don't need to be taking salvation into their own hands. It's yours. So on me be all the guilt. On me be all the wickedness. He steps in at great cost to himself to give his life on the cross, to absorb our guilt so that we can be free from trying to save ourselves. And so because of that, we can run to him. We can run to Jesus. We can trust him. We can avoid trying to pursue salvation on our own terms by embracing the help that God has sent our way in Christ. Well, let's see how the story resolves at the end of chapter 25, beginning in verse 36. We see third and finally that we can avoid doing things on our own terms by relentlessly trusting that God will work. Relentlessly trusting that God will work. Here's the rest of the story, beginning in verse 36. Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to take you to him as his wife." And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her five young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Gollum. So, this is how God works it all out. Avoid doing things on your own terms by relentlessly trusting that God will work. So now that the household is safe because of Abigail's actions, not Nabal's, she goes and finds him holding a feast, like a party of the century, right? Like the feast of a king, that's what it's told here. So this wasn't just like a normal feast. This is like a feast that you would expect with extravagant expense, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him. He was drunk. Some of you have been around foolish, unreasonable people in your lives, and you know that when alcohol is added to that equation, it's usually trouble. So the fact that we're told here that Nabal is drunk should give us pause. He was a terrifying person before the alcohol, and this only compounded it. There's probably a reason why Abigail waited until the morning light to tell him of the happening of things. And some of you women maybe have lived that. You've seen a husband just foolish and drinking, and you're just like, "I'm going to let this go until another day." This is what Abigail's doing right here in this passage. And so we get the aftermath. We're told after the wine had gone out of him. This is really interesting in the original language. I'll see if I can do it real quick. Nabal is his name, means fool. The word for empty is Nebel, N-E-B-E-L. So Nabal is N-A-B-E-L. And it's kind of like now we have Saul, that there's an empty wineskin. It's literally saying like, and then in the morning after the wine had gone out of him, it's almost like a deflated wineskin. Now that all that's gone out of him, she told him what was going on. And when Nabal is empty, she told him these things, and his heart died within him. We're not sure what this means. You know, we don't know, like, if he was just, like, stared at the wall for 10 days or had a heart event or what's going on, but there's something happening here where his heart died within him. He became as a stone. And 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. One writer put it this way: it took God half a sentence to take care of Nabal. It took God half a sentence to take care of David's problems. Is David going to trust that? So it'll be interesting to see if anything's different in 1 Samuel 26 when the third temptation in the wilderness comes. What did David learn from this? Well, David did learn of this, and so he communicated, "Blessed be the Lord who avenged the insult I received, kept me from wrongdoing." David understood that it wasn't for him to right this wrong, that God could handle it just fine. That's what he needed to learn. And the Lord had returned the evil of Nabal on his head. In Romans 12, 17 to 21, we're encouraged to walk in this way. We're told, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends upon you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it's written, vengeance is mine, I'll repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If your enemy is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by doing so you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Is this the way you think about people that disagree with you in this world? Like what's the most good I could do for them in this moment? Or are you thinking, we need to make sure they don't get elected? And we need to fix this right now, because they are in the wrong. Now, I'm not saying in a democratic republic that you shouldn't be thinking about how you're going to vote. But if all that's on your mind is just, we got to fix this evil, and it's your job to fix it, without a trust in God, it's a dangerous place to be. So, if you go vote Tuesday, do so out of faith. Trust. Don't go in there anxious. So, we just act like the sky's falling if somebody gets elected that we're going to disagree with. And might it be that God would allow that so that we could show love and do good to enemies? That we could be giving them food, giving them water, heaping burning coals in their head, not being overcome by evil, but overcoming evil with good? You live in there in that space? Repay no one evil for evil. This is Romans 12, 17 to 21. But give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. Live peaceable. Live peaceably with all. So, I'm more concerned about the attitude. And the attitude is not, in my estimation, what I experience, the attitude's not flowing out of faith. We can walk in this honorable way with the trust that God will work. That's what the whole point of this is. David doesn't have to take salvation into his own hands. He doesn't have to work this on his own. He doesn't have to fix all his problems. God has it. And what Paul's saying in Romans 12 is, you don't have to fix the world either. God has it. And when there's wicked and wrong happening there, you don't have to fix it. God has this. Trust him. That's the whole point. That is the whole shoe dropping here. Is David going to be a king that trusts God? Or is he just going to be like Saul and do his own thing? When somebody wrongs him, they're going to feel his wrath. And it's the same thing for us. How are we going to act with those that disagree with us? We're going to take matters into our own hands? We're going to retribute all the right? We're going to execute justice on our own? Are we going to trust God? Do good to all. Certainly live in the glorious reality we have as a democratic republic. So, I'm not saying you don't vote. I'm not saying you don't use your voice. I'm saying you're filled with faith and you're doing good. Well, and we're quickly running out of time. There's so much here. This passage ends with information about David taking of wives. So David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. Servants came to reiterate the news. David has sent us to take you as his wife. She rose and bowed to the ground and says, it's humbling. Behold, your handmaid is the servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. She gathered her stuff and her servants and became David's wife. In verse 43, David took Ahinoam of Jezreel as his wife. And lest we forget, this is now three wives for David. Okay, and some of you might be wondering, is that bad? That seems bad. I didn't think we were Mormon. Seems wrong. Something doesn't seem right here. That's right. I think it's a good instinct. Samuel said when he was telling the people the problem with the king would be that they would take and take and take. And here, what happened in the passage? David sent a message to Carmel to take and sent servants to take. And then he goes down to Jezreel and takes. Deuteronomy 17:17 commanded the king of Israel to not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. So we read the end of 1 Samuel 25, and we're thinking, oh, that's a happy story. Man, she's a widow. David's coming to her help. This is nice. But we know by 2 Samuel 11, this is going to be a huge problem. Because David's going to look out on his balcony and see someone else that, well, she could be my wife. So, the question of this closing section is, will we trust God to work? Do we have to work all this out in our way? Don't fix these things on your own terms. Let God work. David's going to learn a lesson here, and it's going to translate into 1 Samuel 26. Will we learn that lesson, that we can trust God to act? Well, in conclusion, we've seen three ways that we can avoid doing things on our own terms when it comes to God's plan. We can remember that opportunity doesn't equal mandate. We can embrace the help that God sends our way. And we can relentlessly trust that God will work. So on one level, I just want to encourage you about the basics of your relationship with God. Is your relationship to God based on your own work? Is this like something you've agreed to on your own terms? Are you characterized, or is your relationship to God characterized by trusting God's help? Trusting in the way that He's given. He's provided the ultimate help for you. And that ultimate help is Jesus. When you were a sinner, He stood and came down to earth. He stood and was separated for you. He came down and took on human flesh. He lived and He died in your place and He rose again. And He rules today from heaven. Jesus is the one that you can trust in as you relate to God. He's the help that God sent for you. So will you put all your confidence in Him? Or are you just going to say, well, I'll get around to that someday? It's still on your terms, isn't it? It's still like one of these days you're going to say that, okay, yeah, God, I'll decide on my own terms. Just bank on God's terms. That's all salvation is. All salvation is you saying, okay, enough with my way. What does God want? I'll trust Him. And having stepped into that relationship, boy, we got to remember that opportunity doesn't equal mandate. So the world's going to wrong us. We shouldn't be shocked or discouraged how they will attempt to draw us away from our calling. But we don't have to relate to them out of posturing or thinking that we're better than them or trying to think of ways we could execute justice to make their world, you know, more evil for them or something, you know. We can respond with love. And in doing so, Jesus emerges as the compelling storyline of our lives. Not justice. Jesus. So embrace the help He provides. Are you humble? Or are you a worthless person that no one can talk to? That's how Nabal was described. Are you humble? Are you teachable? Are you responding to His way? Finding steadiness in Him? Finding firm footing in His plan and His ways? And the more you walk in this world, man, your feet are more established and planted. You're trusting that He'll work. God took care of Nabal in half a sentence. What's the issue of your life that you just need to trust Him and say, God, just take care of this. Put my confidence in You. He can take care of the big things that you think you need to fix. Are you trusting Him to take care of those things? Are you burning your wheels and full of anxiety and full of worry and full of, well, if I don't fix this, what's going to happen? You know, just trust Him. Trust Him. Just ask Him, God, how are You going to fix this? So big daunting questions like, you know, Andrew asked me a question last night. He was like, how can I make disciples of other students in my school? You know, I don't teach. You know, it's a big daunting question. I don't know. But we can trust God. We know that's what God wants us to do, right? We can trust him, lean into him. I can't fix all this. I can't fix people. I can't even fix myself, but I can trust him, right? Big daunting questions. Don't need to be paralyzed by how I'm going to fix it. I need to be paralyzed, in a sense, by how I trust in him. So rest in him. He's our helper. He's the one we trust. Let's go to him, and as we do, we'll glorify and enjoy him forever.